let's have an AA meeting. My name is Lindsay. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own words, from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them. I must have this thing. Now I'm going to introduce our speaker. His name is Yona. And I'm so excited to hear what he's got to say.
Yeah, you got it right. I'm Yona. I'm an alcoholic.
Yona.
I'll tell you a couple of things up front. This is my absolute least favorite thing to do in AA. I'll set up chairs and clean up and do whatever all day long. I hate talking in front of people. But I've been taught when I'm asked to do something, I show up and I do it. I will do my best not to curse. Drugs are a big part of my story. I will do my best to kind of be vague about that part of it, but it's my story. It's all I got, and I'm not going to apologize for that. And the last thing is I am kind of a crier, so that might happen at some point. So just going to give you a heads up on that. My sobriety date is May 1st, 2011. I have a sponsor. I sponsor other guys. I've worked the steps. My home group is the Fifth Tradition group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, those are super important things to me. So I grew up in New Jersey. I am the youngest of four loving parents, still married today. You know, it's one of those funny things where, like, the longer I've been sober, kind of the better my childhood is, like, in retrospect. When I got here, I would have told you I got a really, like, raw deal and I had a really shitty childhood. But that's truthfully not the case. I just grew up the Orthodox Jewish family. I mean, my parents were, like, really religious. I went to, like, all-boys schools and synagogue every Saturday, and I hated it, and I never felt like I fit in, and I just felt uncomfortable in my skin. Really, that was, like, the worst of it, but I thought that was, like, really bad. I'm one of those people who truly believe also that, like, if I hadn't found drugs and alcohol as a teenager, I would have killed myself. I've been, like, a depressive as far back as I can remember, and suicide has always been, like, a constant thought in my mind. And especially growing up the way that I did, I just never felt like I fit in. I never felt comfortable. I just didn't know who I was and where I was supposed to be and how I fit into this world. And when I found, you know, being in, like, Orthodox Jewish, like, we had alcohol around all the time. You know what I mean? And I had sips as a kid. I don't really remember it being a big deal. But really, when I found it, like, 14, 15, 16, something like that, found drugs and alcohol, like, I felt okay in my skin for the first time. Like, I found what I needed. You know, pretty much it was like a daily thing for me from, like, the first time I got loaded. It started to become an everyday thing. I needed it to survive. You know, I was the kid who would, like, go hang out with my friends, and I would tell them I don't have any weed so we can smoke theirs. And if they went to the bathroom, I would steal it and go home and smoke mine and theirs because, like, you're having fun. Like, this is my medicine to survive. Like, that was just my mentality, you know what I mean? And I would steal from my parents and do what I had to do to get loaded every day in an Orthodox Jewish religious all-boys school. That's what I did. You know, in the beginning, it was a lot of fun. I don't know. I had good times. It was like the first time I felt comfortable in my skin, and I could talk to other people, and I could come to life. And I had a lot of good times through high school. I honestly don't really remember most of it. I was also that kid who would just take, like, whatever was offered, whatever was around. I don't care. If it's going to make me feel different, I'm going to take it. And then maybe ask you later what it is, just so I know if we're going up or we're going down or what, you know, where we're going. I don't really care. Just want to know what to expect, you know? And so honestly, that was kind of high school and get loaded as much as I could. Now, when I was like 16, and I always forget to tell this part for some reason, I went on this like youth group trip to Israel for 6 weeks. And we had just been like hiking for 3 days in the desert and stuff, and that was cool. But then we had like a free weekend where I found myself at a party and we were drinking, I was drinking, screwdrivers that were like, you know, that much vodka or that much orange juice and like that much vodka. And I had three of them and that I remember. And then the next thing I remember 2 days later, waking up in a hospital with alcohol poisoning. and IVs in my arm. I always forget to tell that part because when I, for a long time, I would not believe I was an alcoholic. I just thought like, well, I'll get to that, but I would not believe I was an alcoholic. But I look back at these little instances that were very clear to me. I don't drink like a normal person does. I never did. But I would have preferred other things a lot of the time. Go through high school, and I barely graduated. I think, I really don't know how I graduated, but the only reason I got into college was because I had took a lot of, like, prescription ADD medications that my friends didn't like that they gave to me, because I did. And I did really well on my SATs, and so that guaranteed me to go to college. And so I went as far away as I could, which was New York City, get out of my parents' house, and for the first time I can just do what I want to do the way that I want to do it. And let me backtrack for 1 second also. It was about that same time, I think it was after I got back from Israel, but I was working this little kosher deli down the street from my parents' house. And I was getting loaded every day, but this dude that I worked with, I was also getting loaded every day. But what he was doing looked like it was more fun to me. I'm not sure why. But he would, like, fall asleep all of the time, and it looked a lot more fun than what I was doing. And found out it was heroin, and, you know, he gave me some, and I way overshot the mark, like, threw up everywhere, had to leave. I told my boss that I ate some bad chicken. He believed that, I guess. I don't know. And, like, we did it with him a couple times, then he disappeared one day with my money, and I never saw that again. And I just, so the rest of my high school career, I was just drinking and doing whatever I could get my hands on whenever I could, pretty often. And so I got to college, and honestly, like, there was just freedom for me. The school I went to was a commuter school, so I had an apartment, and I had no responsibilities other than going to class, and I just couldn't, I never really went. I just got outloaded all of the time. I found roommates and friends who did what I did, but most of the time I was kind of in my room by myself just getting loaded. I was a semester shy of graduating, and I don't mean 4 years, about 6 years in. And I had to drop out. And what had happened is that around that time, I had gotten reintroduced to opiates. It just was not going well. And I would start this cycle, which would continue for years to come, where I would try to detox myself on the weekends, thinking, like, I can come Monday, I can, like, get myself together, and I'll be fine. It was not going well, even from the jump at that point. And I remember it was a Thursday morning. It's finals week. I know if I don't get it together, I'm done. Like, it is not going to go well. And I remember I was driving back to Jersey to go score what I needed. It was like my last $40. It was pouring rain. And I remember driving home thinking, like, I can't do this anymore. I'm just going to drive into oncoming traffic. And I was like, two things will happen. Is one, you know, I'll get in a wreck and I'll get injured. They'll put me on opiates in the hospital. They'll wean me off and, like, nobody knows. I don't know why I thought that was going to work. And then the other thought was, oh, I'll die, and then I'm good either way, you know. But the next thought that cropped in my mind was, but if I don't die, I kill somebody else. Like, then what do I do? And for some reason that day, that was enough to, like, stop me from doing it and ask for help. It's funny because I called this older woman that I was dating for some reason. Well, I know why I was dating her, but I don't know why the hell she was dating me. But I called her and told her what was going on, and she's like, going to get me into this outpatient treatment center and pay for it so my parents don't find out. I don't know why that was the plan, but that was the plan. And so I agreed to go, and I showed up, and they took one look at me and were like, yep, nope. Like, you need to go to detox, and you need inpatient treatment. We can't do anything for you. Now, interesting, this was an evening of Rosh Hashanah, which, if you know anything about Judaism or anything like that, it's the holiest day of the, you know, it's like the Jewish New Year, right? It wasn't planned. That's just when I showed up, right? And so I had to call my parents and, you know, ruin their holiday and tell them what's going on. And they were like, yeah, we're Jews. We don't have problems with drugs and alcohol. And I was like, yeah, we do. And we do. And so, you know, they come out and help me and get me in a detox. And I get a choice between Florida and Pennsylvania for rehab. So I'm sure you can guess I went to Florida, right? Now, I was absolutely not convinced in any way, shape, or form that I am an alcoholic, definitely not, and a drug addict, not either. I just figured anybody who does opiates for a prolonged period of time is going to become dependent. You guys get me off of it, give me some therapy and some medication, deal with my depression and my anxiety, and I'm going to drink and I'm going to smoke weed. I mean, this is what I told my counselors every day. It's going to be fine. I'm just not going to do that again. You know what I mean? And I thought that I had them convinced, because they would be like, great, dude, if you think that's going to work, like, go for it. You know, like, we're not going to stop you. Do what you want to do. Honestly, I just thought it was summer camp at treatment the first time. I didn't care. I wasn't really listening to anything they had to say anyways. But they wanted me to go to a halfway house, and I was not about that. But come towards the end of my treatment, right, it's like middle of November, end of November, something like that. It might even be December. I don't really remember. But it was like, I might as well at least like ride the winter out here in Florida because it's cold back in Jersey. But I also kind of like in the back of my head knew that if I go back to Jersey, like I'm going to get off the plane and go right back to doing what I was doing. And so I agreed to go to a halfway house. And I went to meetings until I got a job because I thought that was just the point of job of meetings, was just to fill your time so you can get your life back. And so as soon as I got a job, I stopped going to meetings. I pretty much lost connection with anybody from that treatment center. And I lived in the same town that treatment center was in, right? I got a job and very quickly found the people who were doing what I wanted to do. And it's funny because I just had this realization a couple months ago. I used to say that I was sober for a few months after I got out of that treatment. But I forget the fact that that older woman that I was dating took me to the Dominican Republic for a week as a reward for going to treatment, where I was drunk the entire trip. And it's funny looking back because it's one of those things, too, where I immediately would – she didn't care that I was drinking because I wasn't doing – like, she was sold on this whole idea, you can drink and smoke weed, just don't do opiates anymore. But I immediately go to the bar, get three shots, then come back with my drink so she doesn't know how much I'm drinking at this all-inclusive resort, that she doesn't even care how much I'm drinking, right? But I immediately go to hiding it to drink the way that I want to drink so you don't know what's going on, right? But you couldn't have told me I was an alcoholic at that point. And, but then I came back, right, and then I didn't do anything for a little while, and then, of course, what I do is I start smoking weed, and then the next thing you know, I'm doing everything else, right, because weed is fine. That's been always been, like, my mentality, like, it's all natural, it's nothing, it's not a big deal, but it always led me back every single time, and in pretty short order, I'm not in good shape, and, I decided I need to go back to school because I didn't finish my degree, and if I go back to school, I'll move to a different part of Florida, I don't know anybody, I'll reinvent myself and I'll be fine, right? And so I find this guy on Craigslist who also apparently happens to be an AA. I'm telling him I'm an AA. I haven't been to a meeting in God knows how long. I went to some while I was in treatment, but whatever. He was kind of the same, it turns out. And so, like, I moved down a month before semester starts, 2 weeks before classes start. We're both getting loaded together. By the time classes start, like, it's not a good situation. I didn't make it very long down there. And around that same time, my sister was moving here to Atlanta, and they didn't know how bad I was doing, but they knew, like, I wasn't doing well because I'm calling and asking for money and things like that all the time. And so she was like, why don't you come here, move to Atlanta, live with us for a little while, get on your feet. And I thought, like, great, you know, another geographical cure. Like, I'll move to Atlanta. I don't know anybody but my family. I'll get myself on my feet, and I'll be fine. It turns out Atlanta has everything that I wanted in Florida and more. And so within a short period of time, you know, it's the same old thing. I'm doing the same things over and over again. And, you know, and but at this point, I'm kind of starting to go to meetings when I got to Atlanta because I was really getting kind of desperate. I was continuing this cycle of trying to, like, detox myself every weekend. And I would show up to, like, Triangle Club a lot. But I didn't get a sponsor. You know, I didn't talk to anybody. I would sit in the back. I would come late. I'd leave early. And I just didn't get it. And there was this one particular, like, week where my sister and my brother-in-law and their family went to Israel for 2 weeks, and I was going to stay at the house, and this was my plan. Like, I'm going to get sober while they're gone. I'm going to do it. I'm going to detox myself. It's going to suck, but I'm going to get through it. They're going to come back, and I'm going to be good, right? And I mixed two medications that you should never mix, and it threw me into, like, the worst withdrawals of my life. And I remember laying in the bathtub at, like, 2, 3 in the morning. It's like the only thing that would get, like, the cold sweats and the vomiting to, like, chill out for a minute. Just having this realization of, like, they're going to come home and find me dead. Like, they're not going to come home and find me sober. You know, and I wish, like, that would have been enough to, like, get me sober. But it was funny because I don't remember what night that was, but Sunday night comes, which might have been a day or two later. Might have even been the next night. I don't really remember. And I go to Triangle. I leave the meeting, and I go right and start doing it again. You know, like, as soon as I start feeling better, I'm off and running again. And a couple months go by, and I know, and my sister and my brother-in-law are about to, they're catching on, you know what I mean? Like, I know they're going to catch me. I know it's only a matter of time. And I have this great plan that I'm going to move out, because that'll fix it, right? And I can't even, like, pay this guy the full first month's rent. He didn't even charge me a security deposit. I don't know why he let me move in, but we're coming at the end of the month. I got no more money left. I pawned everything that I had. Like, I'd have enough to, like, pay him and a little bit left over.
And so I'd use a little bit left over, and then the next thing I know, all the money's gone, right?
And I get to this point, I just can't do it anymore. And it was, I remember, I went back to Triangle, and, you know, at the end of the meeting, they asked if anybody has a burning desire. And so I'm like, you know, I raised my hand, and, you know, I mean, I never talked in meetings back then, ever, right? And so, but I told the truth. I was like, I keep trying to do this. I keep trying to detox myself. It's not working. I'm going to kill myself. I don't know what else to do. I need some help. And some guys came and talked to me after the meeting, and they were like, well, why don't you go to detox or go to treatment? And I was like, I can't do that. And they're like, why not? I'm going to lose my job. They're like, well, what do you do? I'm like, I deliver pizza. Yeah, and they laughed at me, and I didn't appreciate it, because the truth is, like, that's all I have left in my life at this point, really. I mean, I haven't had a relationship in years. My sister and my brother-in-law are the only people who really talk to me. I don't have any more friends. Like, it's you know, that's literally all I got left in my life that's, like, worth anything to me. Whatever. I mean, 2 weeks later, I end up in treatment anyways, right? Because I can't pay this guy. Come the end of the month, I got no money for him. And I tried to overdose, and my tolerance was too high, and I woke up, like, pissed off because I didn't have enough money to try to do it again. And so I did what I always do, and I try to con my sister into letting me move back in. Like, everything is fine. It's just not working out. And they weren't buying it for a second. And so come Monday, they sent me to Ridgeview. And, you know, this is my second trip to treatment, and you know, weirdly enough, this is like 2 years to the day from the first time I went to treatment, right? We're back at Rosh Hashanah, and I'm going to treatment again. And it wasn't planned. That's just what happened, right? Completely over my head at the time. Now, at this point, I'm convinced I'm a drug addict, alcoholic. Definitely not, right? But I'm in like the young adult program. I'm, I think, 25, 26, something like that. And this is now my second trip to treatment. I'm with a bunch of 18-year-olds. It's like their first time, so I think I know some stuff about this thing. But I'm really not willing to do anything, truthfully, you know? But I have this idea that if I tell them the truth, the treatment, they'll be able to fix me, right? I thought, like, treatment is supposed to fix me. Like, why am I going here if they're not going to fix me, right? So, but I got to tell them the truth, and then they're going to, like, be able to, like, you know, therapize me and give me the right medications and fix me, right? And so every day it's like, are you homicidal? Yep. Suicidal? Yep. Thinking about using? Yep. Thinking about drinking? Yep. I'm going to tell you the truth, right? Funny enough, that doesn't really do anything for us. But I'm getting towards the end of my stay there, and I'm telling them the truth. I'm going to get into a halfway house because I got nowhere else to go after this. And I'm telling them I'm really thinking about getting loaded this weekend when I leave. And they're like, we'll go to meetings. They give me all the stuff to do. And so I leave, and I immediately go get loaded. I remember sitting in my car that first day. I somehow convinced the halfway house to give me my car so I could go look for a job. And, which they did, some stupid reason. I remember, like, sitting in my car just about to do it, and I'm just like, I don't want to do, like, what am I doing, you know? But of course I do it, and I come back on Monday, and they're like, Yona, how was this weekend? I'm like, it's fine. Okay, cool. They go on with the rest of the group. They're like, all right, end of the group. All right, Yona, I want to come back to you. Like, Friday, you're, like, freaking out about leaving. Today, you're just totally fine. What's up? And I was like, well, you know, it's not a big deal. I got loaded on Friday. It scared me. I didn't want to do it, but I did it. But it's okay. I'm just going to pick up another white chip tonight, and we're good. We'll just move forward. And they were like, yeah, that's not really how this works, you know? Like, we got to readmit you, and then you probably need to go to long-term treatment. And I was pissed. I threw a tantrum like a little kid. And the truth is, I went to long-term treatment because I had nowhere else to go. My family's not letting me come back. I got no money. I would live in my car, but they took my car away, so I didn't have that either. So I really had no choice, and so I went. Looking back, it's the best place I ever went to, but I absolutely hated it at the time. It was just, you know, 23 guys in this farmhouse in Lawrenceville. We're not doing any therapy. We're not doing any medication. Like, you're going to live here. You're going to go to a lot of meetings. You're going to get a sponsor. You're going to work the steps, and then you're going to get a job. And, like, that's what you're going to do here. If you don't want to be here, here's the door. But, like, that's it. That's what we're doing. And looking back, I mean, it helped me a lot in what my recovery looks like today, but I was not interested at the time. Now, I did the things because I wanted to get my car back. I wanted to get my phone back. I wanted to get my privileges. And so I, you know, did what they asked me to do for the most part. But truthfully, is I remember my first, you know, weekend where I was able to get away, and I went to go to my sister's house for dinner, and I took a little detour on the way to my sister's house. I didn't have very much money, so I got just enough to kind of piss me off. You know what I mean? And so then I got to my sister's house for dinner, and as soon as they went to sleep, I go in my sister's purse, take some money out, and go right back to get more. And I'm like, this is not what I'm trying. Like,
I don't want to keep doing this. But I can't tell anybody the truth, so I go back to treatment that weekend. I don't tell anybody. And they don't drug test me, and I get away with it. And, you know, and then I get a job, and I start doing what I do, and I start getting loaded again. And I just can't seem to keep it together. And I was almost about to graduate, too. They hadn't caught me yet, and I was going to move in with this guy who had just graduated, and I gave him a job where I was working with me. And so we would drive back and forth, and one day we were driving home. He took one look at me, and he's like, dude, you are messed up. And when we get back, either you're going to tell him or I'm going to tell him. And so, good alcoholic, I'll tell him, right? I want to save face. So I got honest about what happened. And all I had to do was for 1 week go to meetings. Like, they told me to go to these meetings, do not get drunk or high, and call us every day. And I could not do it. I mean, that kid kept catching me every single day. So he kicked me out, rightly so. And then I went to another treatment center, and I just repeated the cycle. I'm not going to bore you guys, but there were several more treatment centers where I repeated the same pattern. Right? I kind of want to get sober, but I really don't want to do anything that you guys are doing. And so I keep repeating the cycle and getting kicked out to the next place and to the next place and to the next place. And so I finally get to a point where I'm not in treatment anymore. I found this job traveling where I was gone for 5 days a week, and I was home 2 days a week. And I was on one of the maintenance medications that kept me from doing opiates. So I could just drink and smoke weed, which I thought was fine. But I would also, you know, do something else that I really didn't like, but I did it because I'm not going to go into it. But I really didn't like that particular drug, but I kept doing it anyways. And every time I would come home on the week, because while I was traveling, I couldn't get drunk, I couldn't get loaded. It was like crazy hours, and you really had to be on. And so I thought that would like fix me somehow. And but every time I would come home, I'd be home Tuesday, Wednesdays, and I had no friends, no relationship, nothing. So all I would do was get loaded on my days off, go back to work with swearing. Next week, I'm not going to do this. And I finally quit that job, partially because of what was going on at the job, but I also thought that, like, the job was the problem, and maybe if I get a different job, that'll fix it. And so I quit that, and I thought I'd find another job really quick, and I didn't. And so I'm home with some money saved up from that job, but really nothing to do. Again, no friends, no relationship, nothing except for, like, my sister. And I was absolutely miserable, and it had been a couple of weeks since I had got, I don't know how long exactly, since I had gotten loaded. And I was just absolutely miserable, and I knew it was a matter of time before I picked up again, and I didn't want to do it anymore, but I couldn't seem to do life anymore. And I remember it was a Thursday night. I went over to my sister's house for dinner that night, and I'm just like, I don't know what to do with myself anymore. And she was just like, you know, why don't you go back to those meetings? Like, it seemed like sometimes they helped you. And honestly, it was like a yeah, whatever, get off my back, I'll go. Now, when I was in that long-term treatment center, they brought us to the Fifth Tradition group during that time, and that was back when, you know, they were at the old church down in the basement, and that room was packed, and I remember I would sit on the sink. There was like a metal sink, like sit on the lip of it when I would show up. And I don't know what it was about that meeting, but there was an energy there. That's the only way that I can describe it, and there was something attractive there. People seemed happy. Whenever I would kind of come back those next couple of years before I got sober, I would come back to the Fifth Tradition on Saturday nights. I liked speaker meetings especially because there was no pressure to ever speak or do any of that kind of stuff. And I liked it there. And they would talk about a Thursday night big book study. I heard them say that, but I wanted nothing to do with God, right? I kind of told you I grew up Orthodox Jewish, and I was, Trey loves it when I say I was violently anti-religious when I got here. I wanted nothing to do with God, any of that kind of stuff. And so a big book study sounds like a Bible study, which I'm not interested in. I think I know what you're talking about. I'm just not interested, and I'm not going to go. But it happened to be that this was a Thursday night that I told my sister I would go, and that's when our big book study is. I knew where to go, and so I told her I'm going to go. And so I remember being a conscious decision on the drive there is I'm going to give AA one honest shot. Because the truth is I knew I hadn't given AA an honest shot. I would have told you for the last several years, because I've been going to meetings on and off for about 7 years at this point. And I would have told you I go to a lot of meetings. I didn't do an AA. AA does not work. Now, what my meaning of going to AA meant was that I came late, I left early, I didn't talk to anybody. If I did talk to you, I lied. I'd get a sponsor because I wanted privileges while I was in treatment, but I didn't do anything that they asked me to do. And if I did call them, I would lie to them, be like, yeah, everything is great. I'm going to get loaded, or I'm already loaded, right? And I can tell you AA doesn't work. right? But I knew at this point, like, I haven't really done it. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I know I haven't done it. And so I was like, I'm either going to give it one honest shot or I'm going to kill myself because I can't do this anymore and I don't know what else to do. And so I go to that meeting, and when I was new, I was absolutely terrified of people. Like I said, I wouldn't, like, I'd go to meetings where I wouldn't have to speak, because if you asked me to speak, like, I couldn't do it. I would sit in candlelight meetings, like, in the back of the room, and somebody would ask me to read something, and my hands would be shaking, and my voice would be cracking, and I was so terrified of people, and what you thought of me, and the judge, and all of that stuff, and I just couldn't do it. And anyways, I came to that meeting, and they were reading The Agnostic, which I refused to read for, like, 4 years in and out of treatment. Every time they'd be like, you need to read The Agnostic, and I'm like, no, I'm not reading it. I'm not, that's where you're going to backdoor me into this Jesus stuff. I'm not interested. I'm not going to do it. And so I'd never read The Agnostic. I don't think I read any of the book anyways, but especially not that chapter. But I didn't know that's what they were reading that night. But they were reading the Bedevilments, right? And this guy got up there, and he was sharing what that looked like in his life. And it's funny because, like, in the 2 years I came around the fifth tradition, I remember a lot of those people. This guy I don't remember from those times for whatever reason. I don't know why. But something told me as he was sharing, like, go ask, this is the guy you need to ask to sponsor you. And truth being, if I had any idea who this guy was or what he was going to ask of me or expect of me, I would never in a million years have asked this dude to sponsor me, never. I'm like, do the least possible work, but I want all of the results, you know. I'm lazy as can be. And but something told me ask this dude to sponsor you. So as soon as the meeting ends, right, I leave because I'm not going to hold hands and pray with you guys. That's just weird. And I go and smoke a cigarette and do it. I'm going to do is convince myself to go home, right? And something inside was like, just go back in there and ask this dude to sponsor you. And so I did. And it was funny because, like, also, like, I told you I'm, like, terrified of people. For a long time, even when I was new, like, if there were, like, two or more people, like, having a conversation, they were having a very deep conversation that they did not want me to interrupt them, you know? And so I walk in and he's talking to another guy and I'm like, all right, I guess I can't do this. But it was like, I like walked up and like immediately their conversation had ended and he turned his hand and it was out to me. And I was like, all right, I guess I got to do this. And so I asked him to sponsor me. I tell him I have a year and a half sober, which was a lie. But I'm like desperate and I'm miserable. I'll do anything you tell me to do, which was true. And I hadn't done heroin in a year and a half, but I was drinking and smoking weed. And so somehow in my mind, I thought that meant that I was sober. But it wasn't. He's like, okay, cool. Well, tonight's our business meeting, so why don't you join our home group? At that time, we did a Tuesday night meeting also at Peachford Hospital. And I don't have a job, right? I told you that. So he said, I want you to come Tuesdays and Thursdays and Saturdays early, set up chairs. I want you to stay late and clean up. We're going to meet up once a week, and we're going to read through this book together. I want you to call three other guys. I was like, okay, cool, cool. I can do that. He's like, and I want you to pray on your knees morning and night. And I said, well, I don't believe in God. He said, great. I don't care. I didn't ask you that. All I ask is if you're willing to do it. And truthfully, for the first time in my life, I'm willing to do it. Even though I think it's stupid, I don't believe in it, I don't want anything to do with it, I don't care. Like, I'm out of ideas and I'm out of options. So I started to do it, you know, and it was pretty cool because, like, in a pretty short time, things started to change in my life. You know, like I told you, my wife always says I need to share this part, but I don't talk about it very much lately anymore. But, like, so I didn't know how to pray when I got sober. Apparently that's been helpful to other people, so that's what she tells me. I didn't know how to pray when I got here. So, like I said, I grew up Orthodox Jewish, and, you know, everything is in, like, Hebrew, which I really don't really understand most of it. It's very, like, ritualistic. You've got to stand up for this part, sit down for this part, take two steps forward, three steps. Like, it's very ritualistic. There's no this, like, free talk of, like, hey, God, whatever. Like, we don't have that. Like, that's not done. So I didn't know how to pray. And so my sponsors taught me how to pray in the beginning, you know, and my prayers for the first few months, I don't know how long it was literally like, I don't know if there is a God, which I'm pretty sure there isn't, right? Which I don't know if you're real. And I cursed a lot in that time, like in those prayers too. But I'm pretty sure you're not real and I'm feeling like a tool doing this, but help me stay sober. And at the same thing at the end of the night, thank you. And I started to do that. And it was cool because like I told you, like I'm a suicide guy, like, that has been, like, my whole life. You know, every night laying on my head on the bed at night is, like, contemplating suicide. I mean, I can have a great day and then, like, stub my toe, right? And then it's like, I just kill myself. Like, there's just no point to life. Like, it's a little over-dramatized, but, like, literally that's how my mind is. Every single night I would lay in my bed, even when I was getting loaded, thinking about it every night. Like, there's just no point. And I remember after, like, doing this for a few months, laying my head on my bed at night, I'm like falling asleep, and I realize like I haven't thought about killing myself in a while. And I'm like, that's kind of cool, because like those things don't go together for me, being sober and not wanting to kill myself. Those don't compute. But it started to change, and so we started meeting and we started working through the steps, and like I said, things started to change pretty quickly for me. I'm really grateful for my home group. That was one thing that I thought was really stupid for a lot of years. I thought home groups were like losers who like didn't have any life and they got nothing better to do, so they just do this all of the time. I found that it couldn't be further from the truth. The amazing life that I have today is very much a direct result of my home group and the work that I've done there. But it really helped me in the beginning when I was so shy and so afraid of people, where I could come early, where there were two or three other people helping set up, and I start to feel a part of. And I also, you know, I would go to meetings like this, and I had no idea that people set up chairs. Like, people came early to, like, set things up so it could happen. I just never even considered that. And I started to feel like I was a part of AA and not just going to your meetings, you know. And so it was really cool. And you know, I did most of what my sponsor asked me to do in the beginning. I mean, I'm not perfect. I've made many, 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 many mistakes over the years. I was 27 when I finally got sober. I turned 21 in treatment the first time. And so I was young, and my life was very small. I didn't have a lot of amends when I first got sober, but I have had to make a lot of amends for things I've done in sobriety because I'm not perfect. You know, I've just learned how to grow up in these rooms, and I'm super, super grateful for that. You know, a couple of things about the steps. I'm not going to go into all of the steps and that stuff, but we'll talk about amends. So, you know, again, I didn't have a lot of, like, major wreckage because my life was pretty small when I got sober. But my parents was a big one, right? And that's still a living amends that I'm doing with them today. But when I sat down and I did my demonstration, right, my parents wanted me to marry a Jewish girl. That was, like, how I could make it right. And I was so, like, dejected and pissed when they told me that. And I remember calling my sponsor and being like, this is ridiculous. Like, how am I supposed to do this? Like, I've only ever dated one Jewish girl who was that older woman who was married with kids. They didn't approve of that one either for some reason. But I'm like, how am I supposed to do that, right? And my sponsor was like, you know what? Like, you just keep moving your feet, keep showing up. One of the things he had me doing is calling my mom every Friday before the Sabbath and just showing up and being the son that I had never been. And I have tried my best to do that consistently for the last 11 or so years. And, you know, the truth is I've got an amazing relationship with my parents today. You know, a few years into sobriety, I went through this breakup and I was, you know, for all intent and purposes, homeless for a while. And they moved down here and I lived with them for a while. And my mom got sick. She had surgery and got septic, and I helped take care of her during that time. You know, and then I've got this amazing relationship with them today. And several years into sobriety, I found the love of my life on Tinder. She is not Jewish, but my parents absolutely love her. You know, and she's got a son from her first marriage. I also told her on her first date that I don't want children. She had a 2-year-old from her first marriage. Some of the reasons she went out with me. She tells me now it's because, I would say I have no idea why she went out with me. She said that she knew that, like, I was going to love her son. It didn't matter what I said. And that turned out to be the truth. And then we've got a child together who's just too much like me. But he's a trip. You know, and my parents absolutely love her, and they love it. They love my boys. And they don't care about, you know, the fact that they're not Jewish, technically. You know, when I was raised, and, you know, the way I grew up was, I mean, I was literally taught since I was as far back as I can remember, like, if you marry somebody who's not Jewish, like, you're dead. Like, they consider you dead. They'll, like, mourn you, like, all of that kind of stuff. And thank God that's not my parents. You know, I'm really grateful for that. And, you know, but those amends came from showing up and being there and being the son that I wasn't, not from, like, the one weird thing that they asked me to do, you know? So, you know, the last thing I want to talk about, I only got a few more minutes, is my relationship with God, and because I always forget that part. Like I said, I came in here very violently anti-religious, very loved when I say that. But, I mean, I can't give words to do justice to how much so that was the case. I mean, you know, so I'll take you back, like, right, like, late 90s, I guess it was probably. I was in eighth grade. You know, Metallica, Korn, heavy metal was, like, big during that time. Being goth was really cool. At least I thought so. So I'm in this Orthodox Jewish school, right? I've got hair down to here, dyed black. I've got black nail polish on. I'm wearing all black. My parents wouldn't buy me JNCOs, so I just bought, like, husky pants for, like, really tall and cut them so that they were really wide.
right? AOL had just kind of come into being a thing, and my screen name was Lucifer83. And my principal called me into the office to tell me that I should be burned at the stake for witchcraft. And she was not kidding. Okay, like that's the kind of messages that I heard. Like these fire and brimstone, like you're screwed no matter what you do. Now, interestingly enough, my three siblings heard a very different message. They heard a loving, you know, God that's got your back message. I heard this totally different message, and I'm screwed no matter what I do, and it doesn't matter. You know, I mean, I can give you many more examples, but that's just like really one poignant that shows you just kind of the disconnect that was there for me. And it only got worse as high school went on and went on past that. And so when I got here, I wanted nothing to do with God, any of this kind of stuff. And of course, you go to rehab, you go to AA, and all we talk about is God. And, you know, honestly, if it was a God meeting, two things would happen. Is one, either I would shut down and not hear another word that was said, but most of the time I would get up and leave. I just didn't want to hear anything about it. And I would have these really well-meaning sponsors over the years be like, stuff. Why don't you make a Craigslist ad of, like, what you would want your God to be? I'm like, that's stupid. I'm not doing that. And I would argue with people all the time about all this. I just was absolutely unwilling to hear anything. You know, it's funny. I was reading We Agnostic, actually, with a sponsee today. And there's that part where they're like, you know, Do you now believe, or are you least willing to believe, there's a power greater than yourself? And when I was in one of the treatment centers, there was this guy who hung around all the time, and he would be like, do you believe I believe? And I'd be like, yeah, dude, I believe you believe because you won't shut up about it. Like, leave me alone. And he'd be like, great, you're on your way. And I'd be like, great, leave me alone. Like, I just was so unwilling to hear anything. Like I said, I wouldn't read Re-Agnostic. Every treatment center, I'd be like, you just read Re-Agnostic. I'm like, no, I'm not doing it. I don't want anything to do with it. You guys are all these stupid religious people, like the people I grew up with, and I'm not interested. You know, and that kept me out for a really long time because I just couldn't hear what was being said. And I'm not a religious person today. I truthfully have no more idea. In fact, quite the opposite. I have less idea of what I think God is today than what I thought it was when I got here. I've learned a lot more of what God is not since I've been here than what it is. But I do know that there is some power out there, and since I have been willing to take an attitude of believing that there's something there and then take some actions along with that, I've stayed sober and relatively happy. And truthfully, that's really all I need to know about it. I've got out of the debate society. I used to love to debate with you why your religion is wrong, regardless of what your religion is, whether you're Jewish or anything else. I would love to argue with you about it as a kid because I thought I was right about everything. But I really don't care anymore today. Like, I found what works for me, and it's one of those things, like, you know, the fact that I ended up in treatment on Rosh Hashanah, it's like, I end up in treatment again that time of year, like, every single time. It's just, that's what happens. That I know that there's a power out there that has, like, been trying to get my attention for a very, very long time. And, you know, as a result of that stuff, you know, I've got a really good life today. I, you know, like I said, my wife is, her family is as religious Christians as mine are Jewish. But it's really cool because, like, we get to, like, do holidays with both of our families, and we're both able to set ourselves aside and, like, see the beauty of it, you know, and teach our kids, like, you can choose what you want, but, like, here's all the beautiful stuff that surrounds it, and you don't have to take all of the little dogmatic stuff to be okay and to take what you want out of it, which is a really, really beautiful thing. You know, so, like I said, what my life is like today, you know, like, I've got a really, really good life, much better than a guy like me deserves. You know, I've got a beautiful wife. I've got two kids that I never wanted, but I love more than life itself. I mean, that's the truth. I never, ever wanted kids. I love it. I love being this, like, lame suburban dad. We own our own home in Sandy Springs, which I never in a million years thought. I mean, I always thought, like, you know, alcoholics are people who, like, lost everything. And I didn't lose everything, so I'm not an alcoholic. The truth is I couldn't keep my stuff together long enough to have anything, and I never thought that I would. And I'm very grateful for that. And I went back to school, which was something I was terrified about, but I actually, like, finished and got an associate's degree, which may not mean much to you, but it's a lot to me. That I actually completed something that I set out to do. I've got an awesome career that I love today. I own my own business, and I get to help people. Truthfully, during, like, some of the worst parts of their life. I do, like, hospice and palliative care for animals. And it's, like, been the most rewarding thing in my life. And it's crazy because my experience has been, like, I have these plans of what I think it should look like. And God's like, nope, do this instead.
And it works out so much better every single time. I mean, that was not my plan, was to end up doing that. I was going to do a particular thing, and through a series of events, like, that's where I've ended up. And it's like I found what I love to do. And like I said, I've got an amazing life, but it's all 100% a direct result of this program. I mean, I had nothing left when I got here, and the men in this room, you know, showed me how, I mean, they showed me how to grow up and how to be a boyfriend and how to be a husband and today how to be a father. How to be a friend, and I'm just super grateful for it. I think that's really all I got. I hope you guys got something out of that. If you're new, man, the best thing that I can tell you is, man, like, actually just do it. Like, jump in. Don't sit on the sidelines like I did for a long time. The last thing I just want to say really quickly, and then I'm going to shut up, is that, you know, this was a bunch of years back. I was at Triangle, and I was arguing with this guy outside of the meeting about steps 2 and 3. Like, what does that mean? Now, mind you, I don't have a sponsor. I have not worked any steps at this point. But I'm arguing with him about step 2 and step 3 for some reason. And I'm sure you know these places enough. There's lots of I used to think it was like an old-timer there, but I've come to believe it was probably just one of the regular crazies that show up here, you know what I mean? And I'm arguing with him about it, and he just goes, you know, AA is really easy for stupid people. They come in here, they do what they're told, and they get better. But people like me and you were just too smart for this thing. And I just went completely over my head. I thought he was complimenting me and how smart I was. And the truth is, it took me a few years to really get what he was saying. But, like, when I finally got sober, like, it took it to heart. It was just, like, shut up and do what you're told. Do what your sponsor is suggesting you to do. And this will work for you, too. And that's been my experience. I think wearing a suit and tie and a shirt and tie is really stupid to tell your story. But my sponsor says that I have to do it every time. And I try to remain willing still today. Do what I'm asked to do, whether I agree with it or not, whether I think it's stupid or not, because I want to stay sober, you know, and I have no delusion at all that if I don't continue to do what we're asked to do in here, that I won't pick up, because I will 100% every single time on my own power. So I try to remain willing. So again, like, if you're new or you've been doing this over and over and over and over again, get a sponsor and actually do what we do. My experience is that it'll work, even if you don't want it to or you don't think that it will. So that's all I got. Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you so much, Jonah. And that was great. I loved it.
Someone's hand carry me when I'm tired. I got to go. I can't stay here no more. That mean old bartender just showed me the door. Somewhere, somehow, I'll win my fight someday, and we'll all be together on that Broadway. That hill got flat, and now I won't have to fight it no more. Somehow, someway, I'll win my fight someday, and we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway.